everybody. Welcome to the Introversion Podcast. Today, I'm joined by my friend, Christian Montalbano. Christian and I, we've been friends for a while. We started working together. I forget when that was, probably 2010 to 2015, something like that.
Yep.
So we worked on a few projects, you know, it was cool. And I left New York in 2016. Christian is still there. So we've kept in touch via Facebook. And very interesting times, of course, that we live in pretty much since 2016 on with the election of Donald Trump and whatnot. So it's been a really strange time on so many levels, obviously politically. And Christian, I don't know if you knew this about me, but I was, but probably before we met.
Yeah, we met through Alicia, by the way.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
So you were a very different person then as well as I.
Right. Yeah. So I'm curious about your transformation. But just in case you didn't know this about me, like, you know, I was Christian.
Yes.
And with Alicia and going to Bible study and church and Redeemer and all that stuff. Yep. And I was also very conservative. I was very red state. I voted for Bush. Okay. You know, and Fox News. Yeah. So here we go. So full disclosure, I voted for Bush. I bought O'Reilly's book, The O'Reilly Factor. Wow. I loved, I was totally Fox News, red state, Republican, George Bush guy. And that is how I was raised. And that is who I was.
Wow.
Yeah. So just so you know, sort of my story and background, I'm glad because like I don't even know that you knew any of this about me. But
no, I knew about the Christian thing and through Alicia, you know. But she was like she was Democrat, you know, and pretty liberal. So I assumed that you were too. So
yeah, it's so funny the assumptions that people make and. Yeah. And it's weird. It was weird, like, being in New York. I remember the day after Bush won. I think it was the second time. I can't remember.
Yeah.
If it was... no, it's probably... Yeah, 2004. Yeah, it must have been 2004. Yeah. So I remember I voted for Bush.
Right.
And the next day at work, because I was working at RGA, of course, the feeling in New York City, like, everybody was moping. Everybody was depressed.
We were crying tears.
Yeah. Crying so I'm... Tears. I'm at work and people kind of knew I was this Christian conservative guy. And, you know, I'm not the type to gloat. So, you know, I was just kind of like, all right. But everyone around me was so sad and angry and depressed and at work. And I was like, I just kept my mouth shut, you know, like I just didn't say anything. And, you know, I understand the feeling when your team loses, you know, so, but it was weird because then 2008 came around and Obama was somebody who he was such an invigorating figure, you know, he was inspiring and, you know, and for me as a brown guy, at the same time, like I left Christianity around 2007, I turned 30 and that was kind of the beginning of my departure from Christianity. So by the time 2008 rolled around, all of a sudden, I found myself at odds with my father because we were getting into arguments at that time during the election because I started to lean more Democrat and I liked Obama. Right. And my dad was still the same guy, like Fox News, and he didn't like Obama. And so there was that friction there within my family. And it's a strange time for me though, right? Because I'm like transitioning out of my religious beliefs and political, you know, stance. And at the same time, it made life easier for me in New York because all of a sudden now I could join the party because everybody is all in the Democrat, you know, Obama loving party. And I could finally be part of that. That felt way better than me in 2004 when I had to just keep my mouth shut when Bush won, you know?
But it's interesting though, because you're transitioning out of Christianity and you know, in theory, it's a religion that's based on, you know, being a good Christian. What does that mean? It's about empathy. It's about being kind and loving others. And here is this guy, Obama, who's all about empathy and change and just a lot of feeling, the feels, if you will, you know? And so it's interesting to me that you're departing this religion at a time when Obama's coming in, but yet your dad is like, sounds like he was hating on Obama, you know?
Yeah.
I can imagine it must have been a lot of friction in your family.
Yeah, it was a rough patch. And but I don't want to get all into this for my students. We have a lot of things to talk about.
Just for the record, I have a hard stop at 11:30 because I have another Zoom call actually at 11:30, a work related one. But I think we could cover a lot.
Okay, all right. So I think this will need to be probably a part one then, because we
let's do part. I'm totally down with this. So down. Okay. Yeah, let's do cool. part two. Yeah.
All right. So let's fast forward a little bit. So obviously 2008, Obama, I became Democrat and all for that. And then what's ended up happening though with the 2016 election is I am not a fan of Hillary Clinton at all.
Mm-hmm.
So at the same time, I was not a fan and still am not a fan of Donald Trump, but I could not bring myself to vote for Trump. I could not bring myself to vote for Hillary.
Yeah.
So I ended up voting third party. I voted for Jill Stein.
Ooh.
And because she was the only candidate who was saying, like, I liked what she was saying, you know?
In theory. I did initially. You know? But this before or after you found out about her having a dinner with Putin?
I don't know about that.
Oh.
I haven't even heard about that.
Okay. But
the way I thought about it at the time is like, based on her platform, what she's talking about is like, she talked about military drawdown. She talked about really trying to end the military industrial complex.
Yeah.
She talked about ending wars. And if she did nothing else in her presidency, but end all the wars and bring the troops home and draw down the military presence across the world, I feel like that presidency would be a colossal success that other presidents have not been able to accomplish, including.
Couldn't agree with you more. Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, I remember all those things. I was totally pumped initially. I'm like, wow, this is cool. But then I dug a little bit deeper.
Okay. So anyway, so that was that. So I was kind of not neutral, but in the sense of like, I wasn't a fan of Trump or Hillary. So, but then what was ending up happening at that time, which has carried forward till today, is this complete separation, you know, of like Trump haters and Trump lovers. And I'm neither, but it's left me, there was an article I posted that somebody else posted that I like, and I read it and I posted it on Facebook a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it, but it was kind of like the title was like the politically orphaned kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And it really summed up a lot of how I feel is like, I don't really have a place. But I just feel kind of disillusioned by the whole system, just politics in general in America. And when I think about like people who I really respect and who I really like their ideas and what they say, and sometimes like Dave Rubin, I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Rubin, but I love Dave Rubin.
No.
And when people talk to him about going into politics, and he's kind of like, no, no, no. Like, and if I'm not an activist, I'm not like, we're talking about this stuff on the podcast now, and this has been kind of the center of attention lately, but eventually this podcast will settle down more into actual life, like social dynamics and dating relationships and introversion stuff, you know? So in my life and more personal, but for right now it is about all this political stuff. But if this ever got out there and this really picked up a lot of momentum and all of a sudden I became a voice of reason out there on the scene, I would still say the same thing. Like, I wouldn't want to get into politics because I don't think that's where solutions happen.
Interesting. You know? Yeah.
So it's one thing if we're talking about kind of on a grassroots level or a local government level, you know, where I think that can actually make a difference more. But when we're talking on a higher level, I don't know. I feel like both parties are pretty much bought and sold. So
I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah. So all of this is kind of a background, and we wouldn't have too much time to hover on the background to lead up to where we're at today. And I don't even really necessarily want to talk about Trump right now because, you know, but why don't we, I guess all of that as a background is to Facebook, right? And that's how we have been in touch and also,
Also
reconnecting recently. And the funny thing about me mentioning about my political views before is like, you didn't even know that about me.
I had no clue. And also to add to that, which is interesting for me, like I grew up, I went to school in Princeton, New Jersey, and many, if not the majority of my friends were Indian, Pakistani, you know, people who were unlike myself. And all my Indian friends, well, I don't know so much about the Pakistani friends because they were pretty hardcore Muslim, but even my friends who were Muslim more than their parents, they were up really liberal, you know? So I grew up with an association that, you know, Indian guys are liberal. They're like me, you know? So it's surprising. But then fast forward, I had a friend whose name I won't mention who I really loved. He was a great guy. An Indian guy. And he was, reconnected after years. And he was volunteering for the Bernie campaign and I was volunteering for Bernie as well. Fast forward to the Women's March, which I marched in with my daughter. And I posted a video that I shared with him thinking he'd be like psyched because he was a Bernie guy and it's all about compassion and, you know, women's rights, yada, yada. So he emails me this email about like how all these women are like, he just went off and I was so taken aback. And
What was he saying? Like, what was
he just saying? Like these women with their stupid fucking hats and like ridiculous and how, you know, fuck Hillary. He was a real anti-Hillary person. And I realized like he was like,
there was a lot of that in the Bernie camp for sure. Like a lot
I realized he was like what they call a Bernie bro. He was a hardcore like Bernie bro. And I was like, wow, these people, I'll bet you anything. Like I stopped talking to him, but I was like, I bet you anything he voted for Trump, you know? And what I didn't get was like, here is a dark skinned man. All right. He may not be African American, but he's a dark skinned man. Voting for someone who whose main base is the type of people where if he went somewhere in middle America, they would not welcome him with open arms like he thinks he would be welcomed. So I was conflicted by how he could support, you know, someone and be so anti. I mean, say what you want about Hillary, but, you know, she's a woman. And I inherently think women are more have more empathy than men, politically speaking, anyway. You know, I think all women should just be in politics and men need to just take a back seat for a while. I really do. I feel so strongly about that.
Oh my God.
I'm so done with men. So I was so shocked. But then I was talking to another Indian friend of mine. I'm like, yeah, you got to understand there are a lot of Indians who came here who were super conservative. And it's a,
well, you also have to understand Indian culture, which is very patriarchal.
It is. And I kind of knew that growing up. Like I went to a lot of Indian festivals in New Jersey. And now that I look back at it, like women and men were in different like groupings, you know, they weren't really blending it together. You know, I mean, not to say there were like Hasidic, you know, Jews in that way, but there was a very like the men are in this corner, the women are over there. And I was like, oh yeah, okay. I could see that now, you know? But it nonetheless, it was surprising to me because, you know, I was just going on the color of people's skin, you know? So.
Yeah. All of this shit is so complex that I mean, that's why I like the podcast format is because we can't really get to the meat of the complexity of all of these things. I mean, we just talked about Bernie. We talked about Hillary. We talked about Trump. We talked about middle America. We talked about your Indian friend growing up in New Jersey area. Uh-huh. And we talked about Indian cultural patriarchy. We talked about feminism and the role of women in society in a different culture living in America. Like you just laid out, there's like 15 things right there. And that's just one tiny little dot.
It would be part 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah. You know, so that's why I'm like, I really believe in conversation, like open conversation yeah. about all of these issues, because they're so complex.
I hear you.
And it's really about listening to each other and understanding where each other are coming from. And, you know, it's a shame that I guess you and your friend are no longer in touch because yeah. of these differences. But, you know, and partially, like, I'll be honest, that was also, I've seen things you posted on Facebook, and yeah. there's a lot of things there that I don't agree with at all.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I was a little nervous about, like, because so far I've had a few friends on the podcast, and I they're friends who I hang out with and talk with all the time.
Yeah.
I'm probably closer with them than with you, but yeah. I know.
Like, oh, I don't know what I'm getting with Christian.
Yeah. It's like, oh.
I know.
But when we had that conversation the other day about that yeah. one particular thread,
yeah.
We were able to go back and forth on it. I thought, like, you know what? Okay, this is actually pretty reasonable. I think that we can have a conversation.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, like, I have love for humanity, you know, and, you know, it's really what it all comes down to is humanity and empathy and compassion. And sadly, I'm the first to admit that I've become so much more dogmatic and angry at the current situation. And sometimes I find myself like, wow, I need to take a step back and not be so mm-hmm. hateful. But it's yeah. hard. It's really hard because there's so much emotion wrapped yeah. up in all of this. And when we talk about race, I think one of the greatest problems in dealing with race is the lack of empathy for what people of color have gone through. And I don't know that as white people, we are as evolved enough as a society and as people to really open up our consciousness to understanding and having the level of deep empathy to be able to not judge, to be able to understand, and to be able to have a dialogue without being judgmental. Because I feel like one of the things that really sort of sets my hair on fire is how, like, you talk about race, especially in like social media circles on Facebook in particular, every white person has a goddamn opinion on race relations, you know? And my feeling now is like, white people just need to shut up and just like find, just be better, like you said, be better listeners. And it's about like being more evolved people. And it's really hard. Like, I'm not the person I was even 5 years ago when it comes to communicating. And even like in relationships, I still have issues communicating with my own partner, you know, because mm-hmm. it, you know, the emotional component of our existence is something we've struggled with since, you know, early man was like, hey man, I got feelings, you know? And I think just like people need to step back and hear what people of color have to say about the Black experience. And they might be more understanding and less like combative and opinionated, you know?
Yeah. I agree and I disagree. So yeah. it's a mixed bag here. So white privilege is, and you should hear the conversation I had with Drew. I'm going to post the episode tomorrow because he has a TED talk with 7.5 million views. So
wow.
I was really happy to have him on the podcast and we really got into it. We talked a lot about white privilege and it was a good conversation. Like I think I shed some light for him and he made some points that gave me pause to think about as well. But like on the one hand, I totally agree with you on empathy and white people should really be more understanding of, you know, people of color and their perspective and their history. And just, you know, really just try to understand people who are different than them. But where I kind of draw the line though, is I don't feel like that just goes that one way. I think that is the recipe and the solution for all races. So that's where I would disagree with you in the sense of like, well, white people need to just shut up now. you know, because I don't think that's a healthy dialogue. A healthy dialogue sure. is a two-way street. Like, like right now, if I were to just railroad you and say, Christian, you're a white man, you need to shut up for the next 30 minutes and I'm going to do all the talking, you know, it's like,
no, I don't think that gets it. And you're right, because I would be like, hey, why would you say that? I'm a white ally. I love you too, man.
Yeah, but no, this is also, I'm glad you brought up that point too, because have you seen the video where there's the white protester guys in their window and they're all like praising the protesters walking down the street and then they throw a brick into their window. Have you seen that clip?
No, I didn't. I saw it. I have to apologize. I have so little like spare time to watch videos. So I got through like half of the one by that woman.
Okay.
Was it in that video?
It might have been in that clip for, I don't know if it was in that one, but
Brittany,
there was,
Selmer.
Yeah. So, but the point of that clip and why I brought it up when you said that, it's like, hey, I'm an ally is,
I know.
They threw the brick through the window and the white guys are like, hey, what are you doing? We're on your side. We're allies. We're in support of you. And to me, it was very illustrative. It was very evocative of the times that we live in, which is like, look, I am not a fan of the mob.
Yeah.
And I'm the kind of person where if it's a KKK mob, if it's a BLM mob, if it's an Antifa mob, chances are I'm not going to be on the side of the mob. Because I'm a person who believes in individuality and conversation and the nuance, like everything I'm talking about, like about podcasts.
Sure, this is how
real change of hearts happen. This is how change happens, is understanding. I don't feel like that happens by throwing bricks in windows and yelling the same mantra over and over a million times. Yeah. I don't think that really convinces a racist person to not be racist. Okay. So, you know, so that's why I'm not a huge fan of all of the, I mean, peaceful protests, fine, that's great, you know, but rioting and looting and throwing bricks through windows.
Yeah, I hear you. I've been hearing that a lot. I would say this, and again, I'll preface it by saying I don't condone violence, but let's say that I was like one of those white guys and I could totally see myself like, you know, being like, oh dude, what happened? But I have to say, if that was me, I would have to say like, I kind of get it though, because it has to be exhausting, you know, it's exhausting. And I think that
what's exhausting?
Just like, hey man, I'm a white, your white brother. I'm on your side. I'm a white ally. You know, that's great. But where the hell has the white ally gotten us? You know, even Martin Luther King has said in the past something. I mean, I don't remember the exact quote. I'm horrible at remembering exact quotes. But he said something like, you know, it's great that we have the white people who are on our side and we have these white liberal Democrats. But and they're there cheering and supporting us when we're protesting. But at the end of the day, like, where do they go when we really need to seek concrete change and real social justice? And Martin Luther King was right. And I think as a black person, it's just lip service, because for generations now, for hundreds of years, for more than 300 years, black people have had to deal with something that is at this point so ingrained in the DNA. And it's like, in a way, it's like a form of PTSD. And I think that if we don't step back and understand the psychology of the anger and the rioting, we're just going to think, ah, oh, man, what a bunch of thugs. And that is a problem. And that's why I don't agree that bundling it. I don't think there's a moral equivalent between the mobs of, I mean, I wouldn't call Black Lives Matter a mob even. You know, I don't think, I see a huge difference between Black Lives Matter and Antifa and KKK and white supremacy. And I get the anger of Black Lives Matter, because you are talking about, you think about like PTSD and trauma. Think about, interestingly, my wife and I saw a movie called Unorthodox, and it's about the Hasidic community in Williamsburg. And what strikes me so fascinating about that group is that one of the things that drives them, that makes them so hardcore about their isolation, is a complete carryover from the trauma of the Holocaust. The toxicity of carrying that psychological and emotional burden from generation to generation, that it's what drives you. And I think the anger, like, just, I think people have just lost their minds because they're so tired of the decades, you know, the centuries of same shit, different day. And so I don't condone the riots. I don't condone the violence, but I can understand from a psychological perspective how, yeah, people just want to throw a goddamn brick through the window, because how many times do we need to protest? Yes, we have white allies everywhere, and they're like, yeah, we support you, brother. But it hasn't gotten anywhere. There's no, so we still have institutionalized racism. We still have a prison system that disproportionately affects people of color. You know, and it doesn't matter if you're a black person, it doesn't matter how well educated you are, how well traveled, how rich, how well spoken you are. The bottom line is you're a black person in America. And what we're dealing with is a toxic and toxic after effects of really having like PTSD. And as white people, we need to do a better job at really opening our minds to understanding the psychology behind this, you know, in the same way that we try to understand the trauma of war veterans, in the same way that we try to understand the trauma of people who survived the Holocaust, in the same way that we need to understand the trauma of, child abuse, you know. I think it's on that level. And I think these manifestations of violence are just that, manifestations of severe trauma brought down, carried down from one generation to next. And I think the same thing is going on, not to like go to the Middle East, but when you look at the dynamics and behavior between Palestinians and Israelis, it's the same thing. You know, Palestinians are it's like creating a new generation of traumatized people and pain. So,
yeah. Well, I want, before we go out, before we open up the Middle East can of worms, I want to address a couple things you said there. So, yeah. This idea of PTSD, and my friend Obi, who I don't think you ever met, but he and I are going to be getting into an episode, a debate later this week, and he sent me a whole bunch of links to check out, and he sent me a bunch of videos by this woman, Dr. Joy DeGroy or something. I don't know how you pronounce that, but. But she was talking about PTSD, like post-traumatic slave disorder.
You know? Oh, yeah.
So, and it was interesting for me to hear about. And it's definitely something to think about. I have a lot of questions about it. I do think there is something to that. At the same time, at what point does prior trauma or prior trauma, not even that you've experienced, but that your ancestors have experienced, at what point does that excuse or, you know, make it okay?
Yeah.
You know, for example, if I'm walking down the street with my sister and a black man hits me over the head and rapes her and goes off, and a white cop shoots that black offender, right? There's multiple things that just happened there, right?
Yeah.
What is the news? The news is going to talk about how another shooting, another cop shot a black man, another white cop shot a black man, right?
Now, I don't know about that, but
of course, it'll get mentioned as part of the story of the crime, but the focus will be on what I just mentioned. Now,
well, you're talking about like a media issue, though. And how media portrays stuff.
Yeah, so that there's the issue of the media portrayal of situations, but then there's also the issue of violent crime, right? Yeah. And we can talk about black on black crime.
Yeah.
Let's not even say it's me and my sister. Let's just say I'm a black guy and my sister's black, and we're walking around, and my sister gets killed. So one of those many examples of black on black crime in inner city Chicago. So let's say that. Does the fact that the PTSD we're talking about from generations ago of racism and slavery from back then, does that excuse the fact that this guy just committed murder? You know, we could also say the same thing about a serial killer who was abused as a child. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dahmer and, you know, whatever kind of fucked up childhoods they had.
Yeah.
Does that make it okay for them to be serial killers?
I hear what you're saying. Here's what I will say about that. And it's an interesting point. And I'm not saying this to refute your opinion, but here's what I'll say. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like I had like a really messed up childhood, right? And I won't get into it, but a lot of us have. And so as adults, we manifest that as quote unquote baggage. And we take that baggage to dysfunctional adult relationships. You know, I've been married and divorced before. We take it to bad marriages. And so, you know, for me, for years, I've gone to therapy and I'm still dealing with my baggage that comes from my childhood. But there's a lot of things in place that have made it easy for me to deal with my baggage. I was adopted when I was 10. And so I was fortunate enough, and I had the privilege of my adoptive parents, you know, sending me to therapy at the age of 10 to deal with like a lot of childhood trauma, right? And I've had the privilege and the ability to be aware and conscious and educated in terms of like, you know, psychology and therapy. And I'm really knowledgeable about the resources that are out there. And the key word is resources. I've had access to those resources. I think in terms of what you're talking about, I do. And I will say this, I'll say that I believe that trauma can be ingrained in your DNA. And I do think that it's passed down from generation to generation. And the problem is when you have young kids of color growing up in really broken homes, in so many instances where you really need to have these kids treated, you need to have, they need to work their shit out through therapy and through child forensic psychologists, but they don't have any of those resources. We're talking about very basic survival. And right. So what you have is generations of people growing up in traumatic situations that have zero resources. Yeah. And so I'm not saying it's an excuse, but I'm saying these are the facts and these are why these things happen. And it's all tied to institutionalized racism because they don't have and they never have had those types of resources that other people have had to help them work through trauma. And so once again, you know, these people who've had traumatic lives and never dealt with it, they have kids and they pass that shit on to their kids and so on and so on and so on and so on. So
when you say institutionalized racism, do you mean that as a primary example of the allocation of resources to lower income?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And I think this goes back hundreds of years where, you know, we did this great thing as a democratic country where we abolished slavery and we fought an entire war. But yet, we never really followed up in the same way that we get involved in these wars. But we're really bad in America with following up. With the Civil War, we never really followed up and allowed Black people to have access to the same resources white people did. So,
it was certainly better in the North than the South. I mean, the South
better,
was
but not
terrible.
By much. You know, because people were being lynched. You know, in the North, that Northerners don't want to talk about. Go from today, going back to the, you know, abolishing of slavery. You know, there have been minimal efforts. You know, there've been people of color have been struggling with having a lack of resources for really, really long time. You know, and it's like we never really finished the work that we were supposed to finish after the Civil War. You know, it was like a lot of unfinished business. You know, and that's
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I was just gonna, like, I've ended up doing a lot more research in recent weeks because of all this, and like between the videos Obi was sending me and the videos, other things that I've come across, and you know, I have to check myself a little bit because I have to be like, you know what, I actually think I'm getting too deep into all of this stuff because I'm like, this is not, there are people who, this is their job. This is what they do for a living. And,
I know.
You know, you and I, as much as we care, we do this because we care, you know, and
we're passionate.
You and I, I mean, you and I are on the same page of, we want truth. We want justice. Yeah. We want, you know, equal opportunities for all. So we're on the same page about that. It's just a matter of the means of getting there. We might disagree on, but we're, you know, at our deepest core, we care about people. We care about issues. We want the world to be a better place for everyone. And that's why we end up, you know, reading these articles and watching these videos and educating ourselves, is because we want to be well-informed about these things. But at a certain point recently, I just feel like, you know, I have to take my foot off the pedal a little bit and really just kind of get back to, you know,
I hear you,
my work and what I'm passionate about. And, you know, there's certain people that have a passion for activism and history, and that's why they have a degree in it, and that's why they devote their whole lives to it, and that's not me, and that's not you. So, you know, I have to put a limit on that for myself. But what I will say is, this history, I mean, the history of this country is bloody, and it is awful, and there needs to be acknowledgement of that by all parties. And, you know, that there has to be a certain level of progression, a certain natural progression of how do we ultimately get to solutions to the problems we face as a country. And we can't just jump to the end. You know, there have to be, it's the same thing with therapy. You know, it's like, you don't just jump to the end. You have to first identify the problems. And
it's a process, man.
Yeah, it is a process. So I feel like, in some regards, it's good what's happening in our society now because these things are coming to the forefront. On the other hand, I feel like a lot of this is bad because it's more toxic than anything. And I almost feel like we're breeding a culture now of, you know, how the whole thing about, like, when we go bombing the Middle East as a solution to terrorism, we end up creating more terrorists.
Couldn't agree with you more.
So just like that, I'm telling you the honest truth here. I feel like almost like we're breeding a new generation of white racists because of the methods and tactics and rhetoric of a lot of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now that's a pretty radical statement for me to say, but I just feel like, look, you know, me as a person of color, I've gotten tired of getting emails every 20 seconds about Black Lives Matter. I've had it up to my ears. I've had my fill. I'm like, look, I get it. Black Lives Matter. I get it. You know, and this is coming from me. Like, I'm a person who has come out of Christianity, where my whole life I was preached to, you're a sinner. You're a bad person. You're going to hell. You're a sinner. Every week it's drilled into my skull. And you know what? I left Christianity. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of being hit over the head with this message of, and yet here I am, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, Black Lives Matter, every 20 seconds. And I'm like, look at my life. Look at my track record of my life. You know, look at everything I've ever said. I have Black friends. You know, I love Black people, like, not to be all like Jerry Maguire about it, but like, I love all people, you know? So but at the same time, one thing I've said before is like, I think I just said this on the podcast, my solo episode a couple of days ago. It's like, look, if you're an asshole, you know, get the hell out of my life, you know, because I'm like, and if you're a Black asshole, I'm like, get the hell out of my life. I don't, you know, if you're a white asshole, get the hell out of my life. You know, so I just judge people, back to Martin Luther King Jr., like, on the content of their character, not the color of their skin.
You know? Exactly.
So me as a brown guy, I can get away with saying this and it's socially acceptable because I'm a brown guy. But I know in my heart of hearts, if I were a white guy,
and I
love people and I respect people and I have Black friends and I've dated Black people and I'm like, I'm all for Black everything. And I get hit over the head every day that I'm a racist, that I'm part of the problem, that I have to, that I'm you know, it's like if there's an animal cruelty thing, right?
Yeah.
Like nobody loves dogs more than I do, you know? And right. I love dogs so much. If there's an animal cruelty thing, I don't need to be hit over the head every day with like dogs lives matter. Dog lives. Yeah. It's like, look, I get it. Yeah, yeah. I get it. Yeah. I know that already. For me, that's like breathing air saves lives. I know that, mm-hmm. you know? So, but what I'm saying is that impact that it's having on me, I'm theorizing here, but I think it's having an adverse effect on a lot of the white population out there. People who are probably, you know, it is a spectrum, right? You got your David Dukes on the far end of the spectrum, and you got your regular white people, and you got, you know, yourself, wherever you fit on that spectrum.
Yep.
But I feel like there are probably some white people in the South who are probably, they wouldn't think racist thoughts, but they might be getting pushed a little bit more towards a white ethnocentric kind of nationalist.
Well, I would say, is that a bad thing though?
I would say that is a bad thing. I think white people should be welcomed into the fold. I think we should be moving more toward a society where obviously racism exists now, and in theory it will always exist in some form, but I think we should be moving more.
Well, here's why I say that. I think that I hear what you're saying. There's like a burnout, right? But another part of that is that, you know, it's like a comfort zone, really. It's like when people are like, all right, enough, I've heard it, you know, they're getting agitated. They're like, you know, it's like they're being stepped on within their comfort zone. But then maybe people need to be pulled out of their comfort zone. Maybe it is annoying. Maybe it is getting to you. And maybe that is a good thing, because what forces, sometimes the things that force evolution, that force enlightenment, is discomfort, is annoyance. Because for a long time, you talk to people of color and they'll be like, you know, we've been doing peaceful protesting for a long time. We've been polite to the white man for a long time. We've taken a kneel, you know. We have got together and tried to make amends and come to the table in a peaceful way. And what was the result? The result was Martin Luther King was shot. The result is nothing really, you know, has changed with regard to systemic racism. So I hear what you're saying. It's exhausting. But then again, we're two non-Black people, African-Americans, saying this, and I'll bet that a lot of Black people would say, oh, so you're getting tired of it? Well, too damn bad, because we've been tired for 300 years.
I don't know what links I have sent you or didn't send you, but I've actually heard Black voices say, I'm tired of this.
Yeah.
So the problem is, and this is kind of a...
Well, I would venture, not to interrupt, but I would venture to ask, you know, to say like, well, what is it? Where are they, like, are they living in a ghetto or are they pretty comfortable? Are they in a comfortable space? Are they, you know, like, I'm very interested to hear what are the economic situations of those people? You know, why are they saying that? You know, because I would speculate, and again, just a white man speculating, but I would speculate that you won't hear that from people who experience hardcore racism every single day. I don't think they're getting tired of it. That's just my opinion.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting distinction to make. I would say you can't lump all Black people together. And I think that's part of the problem with the Black Lives Matter. It's such a like generic, overwhelming, for me, first of all, the statement Black Lives Matter, to me, it's like saying breathing air saves lives. I mean,
I disagree with that. It's why incense when people say, but all lives matter. Like, I think nothing is more diminishing to a cause than saying something that draws like a moral equivalence. You know, and that to me, like when I hear that from white people, like that sets my hair on fire. That's exhausting. I'm so exhausted by hearing, but blue lives matter. All lives matter, dogs' lives. Well, duh, we know that, but they're not the people in this specific situation. And I think that knee-jerk reaction, yes, but, is exhausting too, you know, well, in the same way that you might feel exhausted by
But here's an example of, so the guy, Derek Chauvin, the cop who killed George Floyd, he had a prior record, and apparently he shot or killed, it was a Hispanic and a Native American guy. One of them was killed, I think. I wouldn't even ever have heard about that unless I did my own independent research into the history of that cop, because it wasn't really reported on. But like, the point is, did that red life matter? Did that Hispanic life matter? Yes.
Of course it
did. Just as much as George Floyd's life. So that's why I take issue with the Black Lives Matter thing, because it's creating, just the terminology is crafting this paradigm that only Black lives are threatened, that only, that police brutality only affects Black people.
But I don't think that I hear what you're saying, but I think the point would be on the opposite side. They would say, yes, but they're not, you know, there's not a history of slavery. We weren't going to Mexico and shipping slaves north to the United States in the way that
here's where we have to be really specific about the issues we're debating, though. Like, are we talking about police brutality? Are we talking about jobs?
Well, I think we're talking about,
are we talking about slavery? Are we talking about the PTSD from slavery? I mean, these are all multiple issues. So when you say Black Lives Matter came up after the killing of Brown.
Yeah.
That was when it started. Yep. And then now it has reemerged, resurfaced with George Floyd.
Yep.
So it seems to be centered in the police violence against Black people, right?
But also, well, I would say that it goes beyond that. It goes, I think what it is encompassing is the just general lead back to systemic racism, you know, because people have... the big issue with white people is that we have a built-in bias towards people of color, but more specifically, Black people. You know, like you said, well, what about the Latinx American, you know, what about Asian? Like, all these people's lives do matter, but there's not the level of bias. Again, I think it's drawing moral equivalence where you can't draw moral equivalence between the two, because there is such a strong history of this bias against Black people in this country. And those are the issues that get lost when we dilute the issue with all lives matter, with what about, you know, the Mexicans who were killed by police. Yes, we all know that they all matter, but that's not the issue. The issue is systemic racism, institutionalized racism, and inherent bias, you know, and we need to just, because I think they're worthy topics, but they are diversions from the bigger topic that I think, you know, people are trying to talk about.
Oh man, this is really interesting, and I want to dig in deeper here, but we're out of time, right?
Yeah. I gotta go. But let's do this again.
Let's
reach out to you. And maybe we pick it up in the next week or so.
Yeah. Let me know how your schedule.
I would love to do this maybe like towards the end of July. I'm going away on vacation July 25th, and I could definitely do something then as well, but I could go on and on and on for hours about this. I love talking about this.
I do.
And part of the reason, like, it's funny you brought up a point, you know, how like I need to like take a break, because people do this for full time and they do it for a living and it is time consuming. But for me, part of what draws me and part of why I'm so passionate about these issues is that I think about my three kids and the future that they're living in. So I feel like I am fighting for a better future for them, as opposed to just letting them inherit like a crappy world. Like, I want to do something that makes it a little bit better while I'm still on this planet, so that, you know, when I'm gone and they have inherited, you know, the mess, it's like, you know, you and I, our generation is trying to cope with the mess that, you know, previous generations have made. So I'm trying to like rectify that my tiny, tiny, tiny little way that I.
Yeah. You know, so. Yeah. I hear that. Yeah. All right, man. Well, I'll let you go, 'cause I know you gotta get going.
This is awesome. Sorry for short, But let's pick up on a part two.
Cool, man. Sounds good.
For sure. All right, Jay. Take care. Good talking to you, buddy. All right.
Later, bye. Man.
I hope this has been enlightening for you.
The Introversion Podcast is on its way, but we've obviously got a long way to go to get to where we want to be getting to. I will certainly be doing my part in cranking out new episodes every week, but here's where you come in. If you haven't yet done so, hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're currently listening on. That way you can obviously get notified as soon as new episodes arrive. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give a 5-star rating. It just takes a second, and it will empower the Introversion Podcast to rise up and conquer the suppression of algorithms that would otherwise crush this fledgling podcast into unknown oblivion. So yeah, please leave a rating, and even better, an actual review. Just a few words expressing what you dig about the podcast honestly would mean the world to me and would really help provide the motivation to keep this baby growing. Also, I'd love to hear from you at any time. Comments, questions, or if you're interested in being a guest on the podcast, send an email to podcast@introversion.com. You can also connect with me on social media. I am Jay Kaslow. That's JayKaslow on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, pretty much wherever. I really want the Introversion Podcast to be something special. Raw, informative, entertaining, experimental,
inconceivable,
enlightening, therapeutic for you and me. Let's keep the conversations going about a range of topics that affect us all. Let's rise above all the hate and sickness and sadness and strife that plague this world. Let's seek to better understand each other and ultimately live our best lives. Seriously, let's do this thing.
Thank you. Oh, bye now. Goodbye. Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye.